PPI.org.
Today we have two wonderful guests. One of my guests has been in this studio before. That's Lul Noor, a psychotherapist at Cedar People's Center Clinic and Services in the neighborhood. And today I have another psychotherapist at the same clinic, and that's Nafisa Afiere. Both of you, welcome.
Thank you.
And today our topic is a very important topic, and our topic is to discuss more about anxiety, mental health, such as depression, PTSD, and how those affect our community and what we can do about it. In our Somali American community or East African community, as a matter of fact, we have been through a lot. But we want you as the experts to help us define those things today. But first, I would love to know, I know Lul, we've talked it on the last show. Mm-hmm. Nafisa, tell me more about you. How long are you in Minnesota or working at the People's Center Clinic?
I think I've been in Minnesota for over 20 years. I came to Minnesota with my family a little while ago. Mm-hmm. And I've been at People's Center 2 years, two years, I think, yeah.
So you are as Minnesotan as everybody else. You must be enjoying this now. So, tell me more about why I know our communities are scared of mental health issues. You know, you guys are doing a wonderful job by being bicultural and bilingual to really engage and reach out to the community. And that's some important subject. But And as you know, a lot of people think mental health is not just like any other illness. They might think it's culturally think that it's a kind of like a curse. Mm-hmm. But something like depression, tell me about how simple or are these normal things in life?
Well, I would say yes, definitely. Depression is normal. Anxiety is normal. Mm-hmm. Again, it's the levels to how it's going to affect your daily functioning, right? Yeah. So if a person's loved one dies, a person was expecting a really maybe a bonus in a job or lost a job, will experience some kind of depression. Mm-hmm. And that's very normal in all regards. And it becomes a problem when it gets so severe that you're not able to do your daily activities, then if you used to like to go out or, you know, socialize, then it gets in the way of that you're not doing that stuff anymore. You're not going to work on time. You're struggling at work or with your family, with your friends. So because of that disturbance, that, you know, that's when it becomes a problem. Yeah.
Nafisa, you earlier when we were having a chat, you said, you know, things are really as normal. So we talked about anxiety, and you said, well, being on this radio show for the first time, you talked about that.
You know, like Lou said, we experience these symptoms that are markers of anxiety, depression, or any other disorder, I think, throughout our lives. Mm. The level we experience depends on what's going on and how much of a support we have, I think. Mm-hmm. For example, I mentioned coming onto this radio is a really anxiety-producing event for me today, right? So if it was to the level where I would feel like I couldn't come to the radio, or if it was to the level where it's like the only way I'm going to survive today is if I just stayed home and didn't come out, then you can see where that kind of becomes a problem, you know? So I think that's how I think of mental health. It's not either or it's you. It's not like you either have it or you don't have it. We all experience it at some times. It's just we have to be able to identify when it's getting in the way.
Yeah. You know, how do we explain to our community that, you know, that you're not wahwalan or crazy, you know, you're a human being. And every human, as you said, feels on a daily basis one way or the other. That's one question. But my other question is there this state of mind, what kind of levels Does it vary? Is there a chronic stage? Is there a that needs medication? Is there a simple way of dealing, a simpler form of it? How does it vary, whether it's a depression or anxiety?
So to answer your first questions about like about mental illness,
yeah.
How do we explain mental illness? So we normalize it because mm-hmm. it's very normal, right?
Yeah.
So we change that stigma about how we actually see it back home, mm-hmm. that the person is cursed, the person is changed, the person is disregarded, mm-hmm. to no, this is really normal symptoms, that we actually normalize it. We do a lot of psychoeducation, mm-hmm. and we kind of just bring all those examples that just me and what Nafisa shared right now, that this is a very normal event, and it becomes really a problem when it gets in a way. And the second question was, what's the levels? So there's three levels. There's a mild, moderate, and severe. So if we take, for example, anxiety, just what Nafisa described, there's that mild anxiety, what just Nafisa experienced, right?
Yes.
And she was able to come in, right? And she's enjoying our time with us right now. So that's mild anxiety.
Yeah.
So although she's very anxious, maybe she was sweating, she was experiencing some of the symptoms, but she was able to manage that and still come and still talk, right? Yeah. And it becomes a moderate when she's maybe able to do it, but then there is barriers. So maybe she's hesitant. She might, before coming to the studio, she might say, okay, maybe I don't want to do this, you know, maybe go back. And it becomes severe where she's not going to leave the day and she's going to call in sick. I'm not going to work. I'm not going to see BA. We're done. Yes.
Right.
So that's more severe. That's when medications is needed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, actually, the way you're defining it, it's very simple, and I can relate to that because I really feel those forms, whether it's a mild sometimes, because of the nature of my work. I'm a community outreach, I'm a community activist, I'm a radio person, a TV person in the community, work and live in a such a huge complex in Cedar Riverside where everybody knows everybody, so you feel like you're working all the time. So it's very simple. It's just a humane way of explaining it.
Exactly.
But just for our audiences, what languages do we use to describe emotional health?
So I usually use, I think rather than use the word mental illness, I try to, especially when I'm talking with people, I try to use emotional health, just because it's much easier to understand. I mean, mental illness, what does that mean? What does that, does that say anything about, you know, what you're experiencing? But when it's emotional health, and when I ask people directly, like, what's compromising your emotional health, they're able to really take a look and say, well, this is what's going on in my life right now, and because of that I'm experiencing this, or I've experienced this in my past, so it's being brought up again through an event or through an experience that I'm having right now.
So you know, in our culture, for example, I belong to the first generation. We're not supposed to have emotions. Like, you know, we cannot say, you know, if I have a problem, I cannot just come to a group of friends and explain how I felt about that challenge, you know, how, you know, about my feelings. How do we educate our community to explain their feelings,
for example? We're not really expressive culture, right? We kind of internalize our emotions, and I think part of it is a culture that because we don't talk about, we don't really express it at a very young age, it's really hard to describe what we actually feel.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to add to that.
I forgot the question.
It's about, for example, you know, it's hard to see, especially in our first generation, who come here a long time ago, or our elders. It's not really cool, you know, to come to a bunch of elders and say, you know, today I didn't like the what the teacher told me, and the way she or he stated my problem in public. So I'm not feeling well. I'm feeling very embarrassed. So to talk about your emotions, you don't get support in the community. How do we explain to our community it's okay to express yourself and not challenge that as a weakness, but welcome it?
I think, like Lou said earlier, normalize the things that we're going through, because even though it seems very individual experiences, we're all going through it in a community sense. In my family, I know that I was raised by a single father, and you know, coming to this country and really having no support, it sort of changes the role in the family, right? So we learned English, even though he knew English. At times, we were the interpreters, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, thankfully, he was educated and knew the language and was able to join us in this world and really partake in our experience and talk with us about what our experiences were at school versus, you know, and in life. I see a lot of the people that we work with, that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
They maybe are separated from their family, or they're in a community where they don't really have any connections with the elders.
Yeah.
So creating a safe space where people of all ages can come and talk about what's going on in their life, normalizing when they do come and talk about it, and just sending out the message to the community that it's okay that we, you know, reach out to one another, talk about what's going on in our life so we can support one another. So
that's really important. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope you also agree to come to my Somali TV show on Fridays.
That's if I survive this today.
Yeah, since you're losing that side so fast. Yeah. So my other question is, for example, when you said the stage is a different stage, so when it gets to the severe stage, what treatment options for mental health are available?
So I'm going to start with it. I'm going to let Nafisa continue on it. So medications is one, especially for, you know, depression and anxiety, OCD, you know, other mental health symptoms. Psychotherapy, we really encourage psychotherapy.
What's the psychotherapy?
Talk therapy. And I find it really difficult to explain. So, I mean, this is one of the things, like when I used to work in schools, the parents, the teachers, they would refer the parents to come see me, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things they asked me is like, well, you know, academically, the kid is struggling. And they would say, are you going to tutor this kid? I said, no. Are you going to help him with homework and stuff like that? And I would say no. And they would like, what are you here for? Right? Well, you know, I'm just going to talk. What do you do? Yeah, I'm just going to do talk therapy. So are you only going to talk to him? Yes. They're like, oh, we're not interested. So I find it really difficult to explain talk therapy and the benefits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you go to a coffee shop in the neighborhood or in Carmel Mall or maybe Mall 24th Village Mall, or see the Riverside Mall or any coffee shop like the Starbucks, you'll find the community talking to each other all the time and loud. But why would then consider talking out of your problems with a professional is also helpful?
Well, I think, you know, okay, I have to get closer to this.
Yes.
Okay. So like Lou said, talk therapy is really just about exploring the person's feelings, thoughts, and behaviors in order to encourage them in improving their symptoms. You know, a lot of times we don't really know what a person's thinking when they're sitting in a coffee shop.
Yeah.
Or they may not be free to speak about what they're really going through.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I don't know anybody that sits at a coffee shop and is able to really hone in on if they're hearing voices, if they're, you know, so isolated that they're and so disconnected from the community that they're not able to talk about their stressors.
Yeah.
So talk therapy, I really encourage people to sit at a coffee shop and form relationships and talk with people.
Yeah.
But I think going in with a trained professional who's able to really sit there with you, listen to you, in a non-judgmental way, who's able to help you explore your feelings, your thoughts, and just sort of behaviors that maybe are getting in the way of your health or encouraging your health, you know.
Yeah.
So that's how talk therapy is a little bit different from when you're out in the community.
And doing fadi kudir.
Yes.
So we were talking about treatment options at one point.
Yeah.
And tell me more about it.
So Lulu and I want to really share that, you know, no two people are affected the same way by mental health.
Yeah.
So there is no one size fits all when it comes to treatment. What works for one person may not be what works for another person, you know? So we want to encourage people to become very informed and educated about the treatment options that are out there so they can find what works for them and work with their providers to be able to really hone in on what works for them. So the difference that are there is we mentioned a little bit about psychotherapy, which is really focused on exploring the person's thoughts, feelings, and behaviors in order to improve the individual's well-being. The other option is medications, and medication does not cure it. It just helps you manage symptoms. For example, if somebody's not able to sleep, you know, that could be a medication could be helpful in that situation. And then there is what is called case management.
Yeah.
And the way that's helpful is that it connects the person to services through a caseworker who's able to come meet with them in the community, meet with them wherever they are, and just really find services that work for them and that are able to enhance their life and the quality of their life. Mm-hmm. The other thing is sometimes, and hospitalization is required, especially when a person's symptoms or experiences are endangering their health, their safety, and the people around them.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's best for them to be hospitalized for a week, two, however long it takes for them to be on the right medications,
mm-hmm.
so that providers can really monitor them from day to day and figure out how to best help them.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is support groups, as well as peer support.
Mm-hmm.
And support group is really groups that meet and that will guide each other towards the goal of recovery.
Okay.
And peer support is somebody who's experienced what you've experienced and mm-hmm. they are in recovery and they're doing well enough that they can guide you or they can add some things to your life and guide you. And to go along with the treatment options, you know, recovery looks different for so many different people.
Mm-hmm.
Recovery to me today looks like coming here and talking,
yeah.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and somebody else, it may seem like recovery to them is getting out of their apartment today and being able to socialize with one or two people without having mm-hmm. panic attacks,
mm-hmm. okay.
or finishing school without struggling with their mental health and being hospitalized,
mm-hmm.
or for some people it may be finding an employment and maintaining it.
Mm-hmm.
So the different treatment options that exist are there to really meet people where they're at.
Very interesting. You know, so there is no medicine that says or a technique or a therapy that says this one is for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. Yeah. And just the other day I was like at a conference where we were talking about the different things, mental health in East African population. And what I really took from that was one of the speakers said, you know, I encourage prescribers who are giving medications to educate their patients about where the specific medication may come from.
Mm-hmm.
She mentioned a specific provider who was able to talk with the patient that they were seeing about the root of a plant that's used for this specific medication. And that was really important to the patient because he comes from a culture that uses plants and natural as a healing.
Herbs.
So, natural, like herbs as a healing.
Mm-hmm.
So that patient was able to recognize and say, this is a form of treatment that I can see myself following through because I believe in it.
Wow.
So that's why it's important to find a treatment that you believe in that works and speaks to who you are and your core values as a person.
You know, what you just said is very important in terms of us with the different capacities, trying to reach out to our community, cultural community, because it's important because we are educating the community through you that what mental health is, emotional health, you know, what it used to be, and what it is really here, and how to approach it so people can have access, and at least come to you for help.
Right.
But, and what you just said is having ownership of your own medication and process and therapy is part of it, especially when the person who's your provider looks like you or in Somali, as we say, Halima Gabadedi, you know, you know, the daughter of Halima or somebody you know, that's trust, you know, that's trust. So that's a really big part of it. And the medicine, you know, we know plants and herbs are part of our medication culturally a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So saying this is the plants you knew, it's also important.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. But one part I really want you to help me understand is we're different in a way. We are at the stage where many Americans were at one point in their lives, many ancestors of our audiences, when they were immigrants, when there was immigration, traveling, refugee, fleeing, resettlement in a new country, in a new culture, in a new educational system, in a new way of life was involved. I think that's the process we are at last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, do children and families face during resettlement process?
Okay, that was my question. Okay, so I've been working with kiddos for a long time, but I've been doing therapy with kids for the past 6 years, and one of the things that I could actually personally relate to their resettlement experience, because I myself came here as a refugee when I was 13.
Okay.
And some of the things that they've, you know, experienced, it was also something that I could relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
So during the resettlement process, you know, there's that loss. There's the loss of, you know, losing your home, losing your family members, losing one of the parents. And also for children, some of the kids, they never had schooling before.
Mm-hmm.
So coming to, you know, this is a culture shock, coming to a country, they don't understand the language, they don't know the culture process. So there's a lot of stressors around that. There's also stressors of finding housing. Some of the kids might, and their family might be in a shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's that stress of, like, you know, talking to their teachers, especially if they experience any, like, bullying, discrimination from other kids, and they don't know how to express that. You know how earlier we were talking about expressing feelings?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I found interesting is with boys, especially when they don't know how to talk, or, you know, they don't know the language, they will fight. So the teachers kind of identify them easily because they're fighting. But when we sit with them, we realize they fight because that's the way they want to communicate that something is happening to them.
Okay.
Because, you know, there is no language that said that, you know?
Okay.
And for girls, because culturally they're not encouraged really to fight, some of the girls, they've been experiencing, they would faint, or they would experience like seizure-like symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that we realize is that's the way they cope with stress.
Mm-hmm.
So we realize boys, they cope with stress by like fighting, being really aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And girls, they cope with stress by being just kind of internalizing that stress and fainting. And then, you know, the parents or the teachers, the school members, they would come and nurture this girl, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of stressors around this. And I think having a person that could understand their experience like me, that I could tell when they tell me, you know, this is what happened to me, I would say, oh, that's really what happened to all of us. Personally, this happened to me. So it's kind of, it's good to have that connections with them.
Mm-hmm. So this is a very interesting topic. You know, how do you, as a therapist, and you relate to this kid? Mm-hmm. Because at one point you were there.
Yeah.
And how do you open them up? How do you, what do they feel when you engage them and talk to them?
They feel kind of relieved that their, you know, their experience is normal, that everybody is going through it.
Mm-hmm.
And also feeling relief that, you know, if I was able to kind of overcome it, they're able to do it as well. So they could see me as kind of like a role model in that way. And also it's easier for me to just build that relationship really quickly because I could also relate to them.
Yeah.
And also having a person from your culture makes it really easy that they find to be like more comfortable with me than other therapists from different cultures.
Very interesting. In your profession, being also bicultural and bilingual and having all those experiences, that's really needed to open up or prior open this community that's completely shut down from speaking out about mental health, you know, to be honest with you. I see as a social worker sometimes, as a sometimes working with the community, huge problems with kids and families, especially newer ones. And truancy is happening. We are really surprised about this summer too, what kids are doing. So how, what can we do, or educators who are listening to us and maybe dealing with truancy or some other issues, how can, what can we do, or those educators who are listening, what they can do to refer those families to you?
I think one thing to really take or to really pay attention to is that when a family arrives together, say in Minnesota or anywhere else in the States, the family structure changes.
Yeah.
A lot of times, I think the children, in my family, was certainly the case where we're exposed to the culture, we kind of really take on the culture a lot faster than the older ones.
Yeah.
So because of that, there is, I feel like the children are empowered to be their own individual, to think for themselves, to gain the world. And in that process, they lose the caretaker who should know it all, who should be able to be there to guide them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And because of that, there is a little bit of a loss of respect for the parent.
Mm-hmm.
So when educators come into contact with the family, I would say find a way to empower the parent to be the parent.
Mm-hmm.
Give them the resources, the tools, so that they can go at home and really begin to do the hard work, which is parent this person who's in a new country or this child who's in a new country and things that they've got this all of a sudden the world in their hands because they can make decisions, they can answer the phone and can speak with anybody that calls in and maybe are the translators for the parents. Maybe they're the ones that are opening that truancy, providing that truancy information to the parent and saying, well, guess what? I've certainly, in my case, tried to take advantage when I was younger and say...
let's hear your story. Everybody's got a story.
You know, I mean...
Did you get a...
Kids are kids.
Did you get suspension? Like one of the stories I heard, and you bring the yellow letter to your dad and said...
I certainly tried.
Look at this. I'm an A student. They sent me home to take a vacation from school.
You know, it's not like I didn't try. So... I didn't succeed, though, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately in this case. But so that's the thing. There's like a change in the roles that a family has, the family unit. So rather than just pointing and reacting to the symptoms or to the things that are bringing the parent to the table, ask them, how are things at home? You know, are you able to get our letters? Do you understand this is the requirement that your child has to be able to meet in order for them to be a good student, for example? You know, we're just so focused on whether they get to school or not, that sometimes we don't know how are they behaving at school. We don't know until the police called. We don't know until, you know, you're being told your child is being expelled. So, and a lot of times I feel like parents are judged for their inability to show up to schools, to pick up the phone and say, well, my kid's not really behaving well at school, at home, so how is he at, you know?
School.
Yeah. It's not that they're bad parents. I think a lot of times there's just a lot that's going on.
You know, I liked the way what you said about empowering the parent because of the role reversal, where the translator, the guide become the kid rather than the parent. And a lot of parents feel that the system really ties their hands up. They're treated like if they want to discipline their kids, that they beat them up. That's how they're viewed. That's what they think, that if their kids lie about something because they were punished by not watching TV or not doing this or not going to this event because they didn't do their homework, they feel the kid has the power to call the police or engage the teacher or social worker, and they end up, they're afraid they end up of losing their kids. So there's a lot of fear and miseducation.
And just to add to that, I feel like, you know, Nafisa gave a beautiful description of actually that power struggle that parents and children actually face. And, you know, that's the reason that they're coming in for. But definitely empowering the parents and also talking about the culture. Like, you know, back home, the view of the schools and teachers was different than here. The expectation is totally different. So it's not that this parent is lazy, that this parent doesn't want to know their children's or their whereabouts. It's more of like back home, they viewed the teachers as also parent, that they're able to discipline this child.
Very interesting conversation with very interesting two providers from People's Center Clinic and Services in the neighborhood of Cedar Riverside. It's, you know, I have two psychotherapists, and I think I'm getting my psychotherapy here on the radio because this is really, I'm finding answers to a lot of things that I'm surrounded by, because I'm surrounded by the community, by youth, by parents, by struggling parents with the new culture, the new ways of power structure in the family, the kids taking over the family. So we were talking about how parents, some parents are feeling completely stressed out of fear of losing their kids to the system, because the way they would love to discipline their kids, not by beating or doing anything harm, but say, common ways of taking TV or any gadget away from them, saying it's way beyond your bed. You have to do this. You have to eat this food. You have to do your homework, your course. Some kids are since they are the new family leaders who speak the language, are they know the youth, they know the system. Some were threatened with a police call. Yeah. Sometimes police shows up and families don't understand some of them about the English language, and they feel like their kids are taken because there's a perception that some cases, I'm not saying every family was angel, but some, we've seen quite some that end up in the system. Their kids were taken away. Mm-hmm. And that's the worst fear for a family, especially for a mom, single mom. Mm-hmm. So tell me more about how can we empower those parents and what can we do to really educate them, and what kind of access can we create for them to your therapy provision at the clinic?
You know, I think one thing I want to highlight is what you just said, which is the new leaders are the children. And then think about what the police, if they do show up to the house, what kind of fears do they bring to the house just by showing up? You know, the elders or the people that came into this country are Somali parents. They don't necessarily have the best relationship with police officers. If you think back to the stories I hear about the...
In the camps, in Kenya, in the camps, or in Somalia.
I mean, they weren't always there for your best interest. You know, at times they were the ones that caused you trauma. So I can see why the parents are already relinquishing their power by when the police show up. By then it's too late. A lot of times when child protection gets involved, most parents decline to actually participate. They're already in the defense. They don't want to sit there and talk about what's causing the issues. But the child is empowered. The child is able to speak about it because that's where we're living now, where we're where the child feels like they have more information than the parent themselves, and they can lead the discussion or the meetings. So there's already that differences. So if you are somebody who's working in the child protection services, even though, you know, it's very important to screen out for any safety concerns. If this parent is really harming the child, yes, you should be addressing them.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, how much of it is misinformation and miseducation, and how much can you do just by sitting in and talking with that person? An example is back in the day when I did child protection and internship, there was, you know, so there was a time where I went to a home, or there was a case where, you know, there was a child that was tied into a chair, basically, right? And of course, I came home and I was like, oh my God, that was really abusive. How can you tie a child to a chair through, you know, a string while you're out there and are answering the door for people? And I remember talking to my grandmother, and she was like, I used to do that a lot. I had 5 kids, and do you think I had time to look after all of you guys? Like, you know, all of my children? And I was like, what are you talking about? She said, you're not harming the kid, you can see them. So what if you, like, tied them? And I was like, no, you shouldn't do that. So it really clicked in my head that sometimes... our behaviors that are normal and our actions, you know, that could be what's looked at, and that could be what's criminalized. So be really mindful of how a Somali person or a Somali family is coming into contact with the police, with child protection. Be mindful of their culture and their what's normal to them versus what's not normal to you. I mean, if I walk into a house today, my perception of what I think of that house comes from how I was raised and who raised me rather than that person's situation.
Perception.
Right. So, I guess...
That's definitely, I mean, the perception counts, but also discipline too. And, you know, by empowering the parent and telling them, even if they call the police a couple times, that's okay. Nobody's going to take them. More likely the police will say, you know, stop calling me to the child.
If there's no harm.
There's no harm, yes, exactly. And also the form of discipline, too, is important. The way we were disciplined back home is different than the way kids are disciplined here. And actually, the kids, especially the younger ones, they look at the discipline here or they want it here. And, you know, when we talk about younger kids who act up, sometimes they act up because they want the attention from the parent. So if the child has been doing good stuff, the parent doesn't encourage them. They don't encourage their good behavior. They don't say thank you. High five, or, you know, thank you for doing this, or you'll be rewarded, nothing. But if they misbehave, that's when they get the
attention.
That's the attention they want. And they're more likely to misbehave to get that attention.
Wow.
So in terms of discipline them to get, encouraging them to get that good behavior, mm-hmm. not necessarily the bad behavior that you encouraging them.
So actually, I agree with you. I mean, that's really, you don't get to see, I don't know if it's a cultural tool back home that, oh, you were supposed to do that. It's like someone opening the door for you or holding the door for you, mm-hmm. and you just walk in without saying thank you.
Yeah.
Thinking, oh, I would have done the same thing for that person. Because culturally here, people are offended.
Exactly.
You know, something that I've seen in the community.
Yeah.
But when I engage those people, mm-hmm. it happened to me a lot, and I understand that. It's mm-hmm. part of my culture too. So I engaged them, and they said, what do you think you're talking about? I would have done the same thing, expecting nothing from you.
Mm.
So it's part of life. You know, you hold the door for me, I hold it for you. I don't have to say thank you.
Yeah.
So it's a cultural difference.
It is. And that's why you have the child really doing really well in school.
Mm-hmm.
No behavioral issues at school, but struggling at home.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when we see it's because this child is values the teacher who says thank you to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and my mom doesn't say that to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
So, yeah.
That's really a big deal. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely. Children want attention, and mm-hmm. they will do anything.
True.
If they can get the attention by performing well,
mm-hmm.
they will.
Yep.
If they can get the attention the other way, then they will.
Yep, true.
Well, you gave me some good points to take back to the parents.
And encourage them to speak it out with the person who, or whoever they have a close relationship with.
Yeah.
Sometimes I see that the parents do come to the medical providers,
mm-hmm.
and they talk with them about how the school or the child is struggling at home, or how as a family unit that they're struggling.
Mm-hmm.
So just encourage them to engage with the people that they're already connected to, so they can be connected
for
to
the kids too.
Resources. Yeah.
That's good. One more thing is, I will definitely invite you. I and some other people we're going to meet. We Salma Hussein is one of them, which I haven't met yet. But
social worker
at South, wonderful provider. Mm-hmm. She thinks that youth crisis cannot only be managed by youth workers.
Mm-hmm. True.
She suggested that imams, parents.
Yep.
Other professionals in the community,
yeah.
psychotherapists like you,
mm-hmm.
All of us.
It takes a team. Yeah.
It takes a team.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something in the works that I'll be talking to Salma and others, and we would love you to be part of that in the future.
Okay.
There's a lot of education needed for parents, and also access to such a resource you have at the people clinic and services mm-hmm. right in the heart of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
True.
My other thing is, what can we do as a team to really use arts? You know, Somali culture loves plays. and right now we are seeing plays are not coming out in Somali anymore because of the intergenerational differences, mm-hmm. language differences in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember Kachog, Abdi Fattah Phenomena had a play, second play recently.
I went to that one actually.
Yes, you did?
The first one was amazing.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Ahmed Yusuf, who was in this studio, also had a play about his book. So what can we do? What can we do in the future to get you or psychotherapy or emotional health into by using arts as a vehicle, like plays or other arts, to the community? I hope you understood me.
I did. You know, I thinking back to that play, I think it would be really important or helpful to me at least to bring about traditional ways that we healed, like we for even for medical emotional health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we can highlight more of that so that people, especially the generations that are here,
mm-hmm.
they understand that it's not a foreign concept to go and get better through different interventions. So mm-hmm. it'd be nice to see a play about, you know, what
yes.
talk therapy looks like in Somalia, because it happens. It may not just be called talk therapy though.
Yeah.
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 Actually, there's also a lot of cultural ways that I've seen rise up a lot lately in the Somali malls. I have seen small cultural clinics called Shifo.
See?
That black eye and other things that, you know, a lot of things have been blamed for definitely it's a mental health, but but you know, as back home we would say it's a seher, black eye, or all this. So now we are seeing clinics rise up in malls. We're all seeing cultural dances happening, but it's not public. So there are a lot of I think there's a need for your clinic and your profession right now, that we have Somali speaking need to really create more awareness into the community and more access. But my question is, we have a lot of great educators that really struggle with our kids. In a lot of schools we populate as an East African community. And I know they struggle also with having the right resources. Is it possible in the future that we think about engaging those teachers, those schools, and the clinic as a part of having conversations, and say a parent is struggling and a teacher knows the struggle and they can refer that to you?
I mean, one of the things we did in the past when there's a teacher orientation, it normally happens before school starts. If we could just join that conversation and we could tell them about the mental health and just give them some stories, what the kids face, the family face, so the teachers have knowledge about that culture specific or the needs of those families. Okay.
Wonderful. Earlier today, we talked about when we were talking about what problems are in terms of mental health, as a BSTD and also anxiety, and we talked about depression. Tell me more about BSTD in our last 5 minutes, because we, our community, were recently involved in fleeing from a country to a different country, refugee camps, a lot of dire situations. So tell me what PTSD is and what we can do about it.
I think with PTSD, we need to focus on understanding that the trauma part of it and really giving that in space, understanding that it's described as a profound deviation from normal life experience, trauma is, and that, you know, we see a lot of parents, like I've had so many Somali people that I sit across from that tell me, I've seen the worst things in life, I've gone through the worst things in life, and I didn't break down, and I didn't stop, and in fact, I can recall that I was the strongest at that time.
That's what we all say.
Right? And then we come over to this country, and all of a sudden, the person is so impacted by that trauma that happened like 20, 30 years ago, that they're not able to go on with their day-to-day life. You see somebody saying that they're not able to sleep because the moment they fall asleep, they're having flashbacks, they're having nightmares, night terrors that they're forcibly awakened by from sleep, and they're sitting up thinking about all these people that they've witnessed that have died. And it's not to say that the experience that the moment that happens. Sometimes they have a normal, quote-unquote, normal life where they're able to go to work, they're able to function, and then something triggers that. For example, the recent bombings that happened in Somalia, right? We're not there. We're not connected to it. We don't feel that pain. But once we hear that and once we see that on the news, we relive it. Some people think back to the moments that they were through, even though they're safe here. They relive it as if it's happening to them. So...
Is that what they call secondary trauma? For example, when it happens to people, and the people who witnessed it, and they tell you, and they give you the whole full graphic picture of it. Does that also impact the person who's listening to that story as a secondary?
Absolutely. Even though I haven't gone through that experience, even though I have nothing to do, you know, I have nothing compared to that. Like, I had somebody this morning tell me, I was asking them a screening question for PTSD. And she was just like, I don't know what sleep is. For the last 12 years since I got here, I haven't been able to sleep because I'm reliving everything, like I'm experiencing, and I'm remembering the people that I lost, and, you know, my kids that I've lost through the war. Hearing something like that, I don't know about any of you, but when I hear something that powerful, it impacts my emotions, it impacts how I go through my day. So I have to be mindful of how I really take care of myself, and I have to focus on healing myself, even though it's not my story. and limiting the impact it has on my day-to-day life. Right.
What a beautiful day, Anna. What a beautiful conversation. I'm just talking to two smart young ladies who provide psychotherapy in People's Center Clinic Services in Cedar Riverside neighborhood. And they're both Somali-American. And that makes a big difference because that's helps also the cultural and language barrier. Not only the stigma that mental health or emotional health is suffering in our community where people don't think it's simple illness, but kind of a curse for that. It only happens to a bad person who kill animals or people. So we are in the last couple minutes. I would like you, Lul Noor and provider Nafiso Afere, give us your last thoughts about engaging the community, about how simplified such a feelings are, not crazy, so we can take that message to the community.
So as we said earlier, you know, mental health or the symptoms that you experience, like anxiety, depression, especially PTSD or trauma that a lot of most Somali people that experience, is very normal. Experience that everybody goes through if they were exposed to that specific event. So I think it's really important that they seek professional help, that these are treatable symptoms, mm-hmm. that, you know, they're able to go back to their normal life and function, and there's hope, and it's not necessarily a curse or a disease for specific people. This is a very normal emotions that everybody goes through it.
Yeah, and I think recovery is definitely possible, and it's achievable with the right help. So I hope that our people that are living in this community feel comfortable to seek out help.
Remind us again where the clinic is located.
Riverside People's Center.
Yeah. People's Center Clinic Services. It's just a new name.
Yeah.
It's right here, 420 25th Avenue, mm-hmm. Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55454. I used to be on the board. And I love the gym, the free gym right there. Well, I want to say thank you very much. And anyone who's listening, who's interested in talking to this wonderful psychotherapist as well, bilingual, bicultural, please call Cedar Riverside Clinic and or call KFI to be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
KPI.org.